you know, fly from Atlanta on up to...
So we're calling this meeting to order. You ready?
Yes.
Awesome. Do we need to do a roll call?
No, I got it.
Okay. Rose, it's all you.
Okay.
Do you want me to call them, or...
No, not till 10:30.
Okay.
And they said they will call in.
Yeah, we'll call in, and then they'll call in, so...
Okay.
This is what, para...
Parametric.
Right.
Yes. So, thank you, everyone, for the meeting today. And I apologize for not being at the meeting last time. As you know, my mother had surgery, and so Rob filled in for me. So his notes to me were that you were interested in talking about risk. And then in that context, maybe talking about options and some other things, which is what parametric will cover. And I think that that's pretty awesome, because I don't get to talk to clients about educational things very often. We have meetings, we go over your report, I get maybe, you know, 30 minutes to an hour if I'm lucky, and we're mostly talking about managers, so I don't get to spend time doing education. And I've actually got to do education over in Cape Coral the other day for participants. I had over 120 participants show up in an educational presentation, which I thought was awesome. I don't know how they bribe people or how they get them all to come, but they came to actually see an actuary, a lawyer, and an investment consultant, which I was shocked that they all showed up, but it was very good. And then I did another educational presentation a couple months ago. So I look forward to it. Let it you know, be as interactive as you want it to be. I was going to put this on the board, and this, you know, I didn't put these slides in the presentation, but this, I mean, let's see if I can get this to work. I don't know.
Pick a color. There you go.
Okay. Nope. See? Is that it?
No.
She said it was that.
That way it's slow, right?
Yes, there you go.
Say, how much did they spend for theirs?
Yeah, maybe they should have put the
size.
Slow. There we go.
Oh, there you go.
We're in a fast pace, and this thing's slow.
I know, right?
Mine at 1,500, my bastard.
Okay.
We're not doing calculus now, are we?
No, but this, for whether it's your 457, your 401k, whether it's a DB plan, this has to work, right? Your contributions plus whatever you earn on your investments has to equal the benefits and the expenses to run the plan, right? And you know that from what happened in your hybrid plan. If your investment returns go down or your contributions go down, then your benefits are going to have to go down, right? And expenses. If your contributions go up and your investment returns go up, then maybe you can increase your benefits. And that's what happened in the boom days of us having great investment returns, right? So just in the context of everything, it really does, you know, all the debate really boils down to this equation.
But at the same time, when things were great, there was a propensity to spend money on benefits without the forethought of things can go south and have an impact.
So the responsible thing would have been to pay off some of the unfunded liability instead of increasing the benefits.
Or looking at the benefits and seeing where they were in terms of, you know, I like to use this formula of people should have 70% of their income before retirement, at retirement, through Social Security and pension. And then if they want to have 100%, you know, which is basically where we are right now.
So, Bernie, you have the knowledge, and I sometimes think that the city should be a little more responsible in educating the employees to understand that as you get close to retirement, all of your liabilities should be paid off. I mean, you know, when you go to retire, you should know anything, and then you can afford to take that step down
Correct.
Where you're surviving off of, even if you didn't do the savings, if you want to live off of, you know, the defined benefit in your Social Security, you have to slowly adjust your lifestyle. And the first part is paying off all your bills and stop using credit cards. I mean, you know, it's like, we understand that stuff, but I sometimes think that maybe the city should be responsible. I mean, if you look at, like, the Miami Dolphins, when they hire, you know, a new employee, they educate them about finances, how to spend it and how to blow it, and, you know, because all of a sudden, these people aren't used to making millions.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so they educate them a little bit. Maybe not a good example, but, I mean, you know, the education process.
But also what happens, what sort of doesn't come out in the papers, and what maybe is forgotten sometimes, and because I've been doing this for 15 years, and then my mentor who hired me 15 years ago, he had been doing it 20 years prior to that, is that when people were overfunded, when the cities were 110, 105, 115, there was a huge amount of pressure from the government coming down to these cities saying, we're going to start taxing you. You're hiding money. You're keeping money in this pension plan that we should tax. And so there was not only obviously from the unions and from, you know, employees to increase their benefits, but there was a pressure from the government too to increase benefits. And people, instead of what, you know, we have an ALM practice who would have said, no, you really need to back off, lower your assumption rate, do LDI strategies and you know, match your liabilities to an investment, maturity of an investment, and ladder it.
And
that's not what happened.
Correct. And I don't think you're saying that it's the city's responsibility to be a mother or a father to an employee, but...
Well,
but they should be at least an educator.
So ultimately, yes. I think that, you know, when you hire an employee, I mean, employees know that you take a city position because either you're going to get free education and you move along, or you're coming for the perks at the end of your career path, which is a defined benefit. Now it's a 401k. But, I mean, if we look at the outside world, they're forced employees to put in 3%, but they're putting in 8%. It's not a match. They're putting 8%, and that's huge. Even on the outside world, that's still a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's still a perk to come to the city. And they're getting a little bit better with their pay scale. I mean, they're constantly visiting, but they understand that, you know, they're not going to always match the private world out there. But, I mean, they're making it where it's semi-lucrative to people who have some skills. I mean, they can afford to live here and comfortably. But I think there's the education piece that doesn't happen at all.
So how do you fix that?
So I can tell you, when I worked in HR, which was up till about 2 years ago, we do onboard new employees in HR, but it is limited. What they do say is, oh, the city offers this, and here's a card, and this is contact
people. They don't explain how it fits into their life.
Nothing definitive, nothing.
So it's
kind of, I don't want to say passed over, but now it's your responsibility to reach out to whomever.
We're getting an orientation on benefits. We're talking about really financial.
So when they froze the existing defined benefit plan, all of a sudden I had a few people reach out to me, some to Alicia. And there were two departments that I sat down and I educated them. And I was afraid I was going to create, you know, a riot there. Because one of them is the lower income, the sanitation department. And, you know, and it's like using an average income of $30,000 is almost over-exaggerated for the level of them that are there. And when I did those numbers on the board to show them, you know, a 2.55 multiplier times their year, and then showed them, you know, with the variable rate, the only thing guaranteed is 1%. So I showed them a 1% of what they're doing. And they start looking at these numbers, and they're like, oh my God, I can't survive off of that. And I'm like, yeah, well, the sad part is, you know, I hate to tell you, but the bottom line is you need to change your lifestyle. You need to take it down a notch so you can save another 2 or 3%.
Right.
And they look at me and say, well, we're almost, you know, in poverty as it is now. And I said, I'm just, you know, showing you what the future looks like because nobody's ever educated us.
So my question is, does the city or human resources or something provide financial education to employees?
They do not.
No. Right.
Well, so even go all the way back to the school system. Did they ever teach a kid how to balance his checkbook?
The vendor's supposed to, so I think you have ICMA, is that who?
Right.
So ICMA is...
I don't have ICMA.
Okay, so I'm not involved in the 457 program, I'm not a consultant to that, but I do consult to many large defined contribution plans for other plans, and ICMA is like a Fidelity or like Empower or Prudential, and they oversee your 457 plan, and they should have a rep. I'm sure there's a rep.
So we do have one rep, but what ICMA stands for scares me as it is, because it's for city managers.
Yeah, I don't get it.
Well, different level of...
City managers are in a different savings plan.
Right, they're not even under the pension plan.
So just, I mean, they should be providing education, and, you know, that's something where, with any vendor, you have to push them that what you need and how much more you need and those kind of things. But also sometimes it's a, can you get the people to come out and actually be educated, and mm-hmm. a lot of times you can't get people to...
I wonder, does Adam still go to the new hire orientations?
No, he does not. Okay. He just does individual meetings.
But he used to go to orientation, correct?
He used to go to orientation, and so did I.
Okay.
But they cut that back to just a couple of hours now. I mean, it used to be an all-day thing for a new hire. It's literally 2 or 3 hours now.
Yeah, they really streamlined it, but...
Then we also, Adam and I, used to do a course 4 or 5 times a year with Social Security for those that were interested. And we had small attendance the last couple, so it kind of just went by the wayside.
Right? Typical.
Yeah.
Well, I can just tell you the norm is most of the mentality is the city's going to take care of it.
Yeah.
And they really don't realize that, you know, they're responsible for their own, you know, retirement and direction, and they don't realize what it takes. I mean, even looking at Social Security, I mean, there's almost 200 different ways you can collect Social Security, especially if you're married and your wife is close in age. I mean,
they just close that loophole.
A couple.
But you follow what I'm saying? Yeah. I mean, you know, it's huge, and to some of these people, it's mind-boggling. So they'd rather, you know, be ignorant about it all.
And that's what there's new research out, and I go to the National Conference for Defined Contribution Plans for All Public Funds. So it's a huge conference. It's like NC First for DB plans, but it's for the DC world. And there's a lot of behavioral economics people there. Like, how do you change people's behavior? How do you get better results? How do you, because the results from a DC plan versus a DB plan, the results are poor, you know, comparatively to getting people to where you want them to be retirement ready. And how do you do that? And actually, I mean, sadly, in one sentence, I mean, the only actual way to move people is to auto-enroll people and auto-escalate. That's the only successful, and the stick rate's like 95%. You tell people it's optional, you could go down and change it back to zero or whatever you want to, but we're going to automatically roll you at one, and then we're going to keep increasing each year up to 5, 6, or whatever it is, and nobody goes down and opts out. People just
don't think about it.
And they do, and that's actually, in the DC world, the only thing that anybody's ever found to get people to actually save more is to...
It's law now, correct?
No, it's not law.
I thought most companies automatically do it.
Oh, yeah, they do it, but it's not law. But a lot of companies do it, and a lot of states have passed it. They had sort of a law against it, or they were concerned that the law might say they couldn't do that. So there's a lot of states who have started to do that more for their people. And that's the only thing that's been successful. But I want to get back to this, and what we're going to be talking about today is asset allocation in the context of risk. And what does that mean? So on page one, we talked a little bit about the challenging environment for pension plans. What has made the environment difficult? The investment environment has made it difficult. The regulatory environment has made it difficult. And the maturing of plans, right? We have a demographic issue. That's also made it difficult. So if we move to page two, just a little quote there. Prediction is very difficult, especially if it's about the future, and we sort of know that. So talk a little bit about the investment environment. So this is coming off the late 90s. What has equities done? What has fixed income done? What has liabilities done? Well, when you're tracking the liabilities at an assumed rate of return of 8% or 7.5% or 7%, then your liabilities keep going up, right? Even regardless of how many actives you hire or, you know, additional, your liabilities are going up because you're assuming you're getting a certain return. Bonds have been on the longest, you know, bond rally that we've had. If you've been at multiple meetings with me, you're probably sick of me saying that, but it's a 30-year bond rally. And then equities have moved around a lot, but, you know, this data through 2012 didn't really get much. They did increase in 13 and 14. We had some great years for equities, but you're sort of seeing a little bit of a correction here in the last week. And so we're going to get back down to that level there.
Are any of these numbers relevant to our plan?
I think all of this backdrop is relevant to your plan, but these aren't specific to you.
Okay.
So page 4 talks about funded ratio. And I have specifics about your plan that I'll talk about after we get into it a little bit. Funded ratio equals your assets versus your liabilities. So we talked a little bit about that. People were over 100% funded. 2008 happened. A lot of people became underfunded. And so what has contributed to that? So, you know, you have equities and bonds. It used to be a 60-40 split people invested in. And, that didn't help the situation. So that's historically what happened. What does the future look like? So page 6, what does the future look like? Bond yields. So typically when we're trying to figure out what bonds are going to do on a forward-looking basis, we look at the 7-year forward rate. And that's, you know, spot rate out there in the market. So the 7-year forward rate is about 2%. So if we're going to get 2% on bonds, then to meet our 7%, we'd have to get money from somewhere else. Right, so page 7, equities. Are we going to get the money from equities? Equities are priced reasonably, we feel like, right now, but it's going to be a challenging environment. I think in our assumption rates, it's close to 8% you think you're going to get from equities. So you've got equities maybe at 8, bonds at 2, so you need to do something else within the allocation to get to your 7%. So in summary, modest bond returns in the short to immediate term. We predict over the long term maybe getting about 4% from bonds. So in the short term, maybe 2. Over 20 years, around 4. Equity returns look attractive relative to cash and bonds, but still not, you know, those huge 10, 12% returns that people talk about from equities. And so really, we look at the alternative space, and we really look at different private equity, hedge funds, different things in the alternative space to make up that. And real estate. Real estate has performed very well for your portfolio. Let's talk a little bit about the regulatory environment on page 10. You may know that the, you know, Pension Protection Act was passed in 2008 for union plans, for Taft-Hartley plans. You have the new GASB rules, GASB 67, GASB 68, which has, you know, caused major issues on your balance sheet, on the CAFR. You've had to disclose what the pension liability is. On the Pension Protection Act, it says to be a well-funded plan, you need to be at 80%. So, and there's lots of plans, yours included, that's not at 80%. So contributions less actuarial costs of the plan need to maintain a positive credit balance. So we move on to tab 4. And sort of the last sort of challenge here we highlighted is the maturity, right? So when you have a young plan, you have 70% of it actives. So you've got active employees, and you've got about 20% pensioners, 30%, you know, pensions, or, you know, and you got a little bit of inactives there. That's that first chart. So it's quickly growing. The pension and beneficiary population small versus the actives. Benefit payments less the cash contributions. So you've got more cash coming in than you're paying out. That means, and that means from my point of view as an investment consultant, if you have more cash coming in than you're paying out, I don't have to really worry about liquidity, right? I can invest all that money, and I don't have to worry about you needing it. Well, in the opposite situation, where you see a mature plan where 60%, and maybe Alicia can tell us where you are. I know you're more of a mature plan. You've got 60% pensioners and 33% active. You've got a gap between contributions and money going out.
Also,
this year, actually, what's coming in is actually paying the bills. I actually have a little bit of a surplus I was going to talk to you about.
That's great. That's great. So that's a good...
Better this year than last year.
Yeah.
About every 2 months, I was calling...
Right.
Yeah, where are we going to get a little cash from?
Yeah.
We pay out, just so you know, almost $800,000 a month in checks.
Carry benefits.
Right. So, you know...
That's if there's no lump sums or... Right.
And we still have some people in the drop that, you know, can pull out huge amounts. And some people occasionally all of a sudden say, hey, I want to leave, and they want 25% out. And so Alicia has to go find that money. She goes to Rose for...
In your asset allocation.
Who can we liquidate a little bit? Who has a little bit extra? I mean, because as we try to balance our money, I mean, it's always a little bit extra here, or a little shy here. And so that's one of the things Rose does, is helps Alicia. It's like, oh, to pull a million from that.
Okay.
It's just trying to help you come up to speed, Connie.
Thank you.
So if we move to page 13, that just shows what would happen if your contributions versus your benefit payments. So as plans become more and more mature, that adds to the risk level, right? If you have any illiquid investments, that's going to affect that if you need more money than you actually receive in contributions. Now page 14 also illustrates that. So as funds mature, a significant gap between contributions and benefit payments develop. Adds risk to illiquid investments, increases return demands in an underfunded position. We're
about to tab 5. Remind me what our unfunded, what our percentage is.
60-ish. Is that right?
Yeah, somewhere around there.
I didn't have the latest actuary study.
We're unfunded. Do you know what ratio we're at right now?
We're still hovering around 52.
Still in the 50s? I thought we moved up.
We should be at 80 at least.
Yes.
Yeah.
We'll get our report at the beginning of March for September 15. So
those are things, I don't think you were here for the last actuary report, but when we get those, that's when we see those finite numbers.
I think I was.
Yeah, but probably weren't in tune as much to know to look at those.
Well, we're working on it.
But yeah, unfunded, the state stepped in and, the government that we need to be higher, and it's like, how do we do it? And that's why they froze the plan, thinking, it was a bleeding, bleeders need to be stopped. And I mean, I understand, but we should have just cut back on benefits, because by changing the plan, a bunch of people jumped ship where they were contributing money. Now they went into a defined contribution.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So now the city's not matching, putting in for the benefit plan. So the dynamics have changed when they froze the plan and started two new plans.
Right.
It goes back to my equation on the floor there.
Absolutely.
But page 15, just the quote there, risk means more things can happen than will happen, right? So what do we do? What are strategies for the current environment? So we laid out what the current environment is, which we've got regulatory issues, we have investment issues, we have maturity issues. So those are things we have to all look at. So our philosophy is that the fund's investment decisions need to go beyond just trying to match the liability's interest rate assumption, right? So here's sort of the actuary says, okay, your assumption 7, or your assumption 7.5, or it's 6.5. We feel like you need to go beyond just looking at that rate and developing a mix. I can develop you a mix for anything, but you really need to think about risk. You need to really talk about risk, think about risk, and the focus really should move from thinking about, did I achieve my 7, which is what people think, did I achieve my 7, which is the old thinking, is, did my funded ratio improve? That's what we're trying to do, is really we need to be thinking about, did the funding ratio improve? Is it on a path to continue to improve? And what do we do when it does improve? Are there things we can do if we do get up to an 80% funded ratio, or if we get up to 70, or is there things we can do within your asset allocation to ratchet down risk so as you get more funded, you're not risking that funded position, right?
So John, just so you understand, and Connie, is when the actuary report comes out and we set an expected, you know, return on our investment, if we don't meet it, the city has to throw in more money. So if you look at what we're paying now for the employees that are active in the plan, what is it, 92% now?
Yeah.
It's like 92% of their salary goes into the pension plan.
Catch that now. Just round the numbers up. Figure out what the payroll of the people is. And they've got to match that in terms of a contribution to the plan.
I'm just kind of throwing it on the table so y'all, you know, because you're still kind of, you know, it is huge. And it's the city's responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And the city is the city of Oakdale.
Right.
So it's all the residents, you know, and it's trying to keep the tax base where it is to still, you know. So it becomes, you know, a concatenated issue of how do we deal with this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, our obligation is to the fund. But, you know, I also like to throw out, you know, about all the other caveats that help this work. And the bottom line is city council just knows that all of a sudden, you know, they're paying a little bit more money, but, you know, they don't get deeply involved with what goes on here. All they hear is the hoopla that comes out that we're underfunded. Well, why are we underfunded, you know? And they're the ones who approve, you know, when we did these enhancements back in 08 where we put in the multiplier and, you know, changed it, where we put in the COLA.
Right.
But they really didn't understand what they agreed to. They just said, yeah, time
to go. And some of the guys aren't here anymore.
Well,
yeah,
right. And you've done well with your investments. Yeah. Over time, I've been here since 2000. Your investments have always done very well. And so in the boom days coming, you know, through 2006, 2007, they're like, well, look how great we're doing. We're at, you know, 80-something percent funded. If we increase the benefits, that only drops us to 84. Why not offer these things? And that has really hurt once, you know, we get into an environment, an investment environment that hasn't been favorable. So that's that. That's the second point, which is focus on obtaining and maintaining a well-funded plan. And so that's really sort of the change in mindset, the change in focus. And what is important to understand? The maturity of your system. So it's important to understand cash flow, like Alicia had talked about. The cash contribution structure, how much the employees are putting in, how much the employer is putting in. The benefit payment profile. And then you don't have zone certification, thankfully, but the impact on the funded ratio, anything that you do. So dynamic asset allocation is sort of what we're going to talk about. The essence of investment management is the management of risks, not the management of returns. So page 18. Where on the efficient frontier should the fund set its asset allocation? And we recently did an asset allocation study for you, and we'll talk sort of at the end of this presentation if you want at the next meeting to maybe bring a refresher of the mix and where you are and what the standard deviation is, and I have no problem doing that. I wanted this to be very educational, and I didn't bring all your stuff, but we can do that in a month, and I can bring that. But this is what we did, and we changed your policy index in 2014. And we took a lot of risk off the table. You had been trying to get 8% return in a very asset-focused sort of way. And that sort of led down a path of taking more risk. You had to have more equities. You had to do a lot of things. And so what we did was we looked at your assumptions now 7, and we looked at, okay, what are the risks around that, and how can we lower your risk level. So, where on the efficient frontier should the fund set its asset allocation? Next page. Where on the efficient frontier should the fund set its asset higher return and risk low? So this is the efficient frontier. This line, this red line on page 19, represents portfolios, okay? Mixes of various portfolios. They are all efficient portfolios. They're all efficient, but some earn a lower return. So if you find the six mark there on the axis there for expected return, and then you sort of move that over, and then you sort of see, you put a dot there on the red line, and then you go down. And so that's probably a risk of about 7.5, okay? But you're only going to get 6%, right? So that's a lower risk portfolio, and it produces a lower return. Now, if you move at 8 and you go over, that's going to significantly increase your risk to maybe about 14, almost 15%. So you have to sort of really balance those two things. So page 20. Often the focus is on matching the liabilities to the interest rate assumption, and that's not what we want to do. Look at page 21. We really want to look at where your funded ratio is, right? So this is a sample plan. This isn't yours. But as the funded position has gone up, What should have happened is in, say, 07, you got a funded ratio of 95%. Some of that risk should have come off the table, and it probably would have brought the funded ratio down because you would have lowered the interest rate assumption, but you wouldn't have had this huge decline to 55 and 56% when the markets corrected, okay? So higher funded ratios provide benefit security, provides contribution stability. And it takes a lot of that pressure off the city. Now, we're not here to make the city, you know, that's not really our job, is to put, but that's important for the stability of the plan. Your plan doesn't get cut. The benefits don't get cut if you have a good funded ratio and the pressure is off the city for putting in a significant amount of money. And it helps them budget better from year to year. Page 22. Well, how do you do that? So the traditional approach, which we talked about, is you set an allocation based on the interest rate. A dynamic approach is that your asset allocation changes as your funded position changes. Okay, so if you see here on the left, the funded position is at 70% and they have 50% in equities and various other asset classes. As their funded ratio goes up, you can see that equity portion goes down to about 20% of the portfolio. Mm-hmm. So it's more dynamic, and it's set on more of like a, what they call a glide path for your funded ratio. Page 23 illustrates that a little bit more. So as you're better funded, you take your risk down. And so what we can do for you is actually set a policy that would say, when we hit this funded, we'll lower our risk. When we hit this funded, we'll lower it. And so we set these set points for your, you can set that in your policy to say, as we get more funded, we're going to dial back our risk.
And we're not doing that now.
No, we're not doing that now.
It's not automatic, it's manual.
Right. It's something we talk about and something we've done, but it's not anything that you've set in policy.
So John, just so you know, we only meet 4 times a year.
Right.
And our process is extremely slow at getting a few things changed. So in 08, we meet at the beginning of the year, and by the middle of the year, you know, things are looking good, and then all of a sudden everything took a tank. Mm-hmm. Well, by then, what did we lose? $34 million. you know, and we're no different than anyone else out there with what happened. And yeah, probably when it was getting there, but I mean, you know, you never know when to call it good enough. I mean, it's just like when you go to the casino, you know, you're on a winning streak. When you should take some of it off the table and make it more secure.
There's a lot about hindsight, too.
Absolutely.
You have hindsight bias. Yeah.
So there's companies that say, you know, as soon as the peak starts to come down, they'll sell real quick, you know? Mm-hmm. And as soon as the low is... But yeah, you can't.
Well, that's market timing.
Right.
Where you get out. And my hope, again, from this educational session is that we'll stay in the market. It's just when we think there's a peak.
Well,
we would,
not
we
necessarily
would,
that,
we would,
but when do we take some of that risk off? Because
well, that's
we,
with the put.
Right.
With the put. you know, if we do options with the put, we think we're up here, and it's time to get out, we do a put, and it, we come down, but we...
So where I let off with this is because we only meet quarterly and we watch stuff. Remember, everything's long-term. So we ride it out, because our goals are way down the road of what we're doing. And I understand where the city went and froze the plan, because, you know, somebody projected that, you know, yeah, it's going to hurt for several years, but in about 15 years, there's going to be a lot of people who are going to retire, and there's going to be, you know, a change of what the unfunded is, and that's their thoughts. Whereas, like Bernie and I say, well, you know, you should have just removed all of the good benefits you got off of it. Lower the multiplier, get rid of the COLA. I mean, readjust the plan, but, you know, don't just abolish it. Don't freeze it and move on. But there's different mindsets for this. And this is an open forum, so that's kind of why, you know, when we have our normal meetings, you know, we're trying to get so much stuff done, and that's the luxury of this special meeting, is we have time that we can discuss stuff.
Right.
You know, it's... So, I know, like, the fire department is a little more reactive. I mean, they make some changes on the fly if they think something's going on, which they don't meet like we do. But they're a little more dynamic as far as the way they do some stuff. And it's the right way. It's more work for Alicia, for sure, but...
And it's kind of like, you know, I've been advocating, you know, not wanting to figure out risk mitigation strategies from the get-go since I've been sitting on this board. And, you know, I attribute all of the, you brought up earlier the fact, you know, when the funded ratios were up, you know, then the government is saying, you got too much in these plans, you know. Government policy, okay, probably contributed. Government policy, again, has contributed in this market going up the way that it's gonna. And, you know, when anything does that, you know, when it gets pricked, it doesn't do that, you know, it goes the other direction. So if we only meet four times a year, how do we deal with that? Well, the dynamic in terms of this stuff kind of operating under a plan where things come in. And I would say the same thing with regard to any option strategy that we would envision. And that would be like trailing stops. You know, as the market goes up, we move the stop loss point before, you know, the...
Let's get a little bit ahead, because they actually, in these presentations, they have other pension plans that have, in, you know, enacted strategies, what it costs, and what the results were. So I don't want to get too ahead of that.
Yeah.
They'll talk about that. I'm not an options trader. That's not what I do. So, but that's what they do, and that's what they've done, and they manage $90 billion for people. And so they'll talk to you about what that means, how that's happened, and you know.
And again, my thrust as far as this is concerned, instead of having lost $34 million, you know, we might have only lost $17 million. And that'd be $17 million more against the unfunded liability. See, I just don't want to be given this back. And we're talking about risk mitigation. We're talking about insuring the portfolio. And, you know, the approach that I'm looking at is options. But I think what we also need to look at is ALM.
Yep.
Matching assets and liability in terms of all of, and I think we're moving. I think we're moving in that direction.
Well, we have about 15 minutes before we get them on the phone. So let's see if we can get through a little bit more of this. So the next page here talks about, so your funded ratio is the actuarial value over your liabilities at like the 7.5 interest. You have a 7% rate. Okay? What happens is, as you get more funded, what you end up doing is, if you look at the bottom one, you see that return assumption at 5.5%. So you're more funded, so you're taking that interest rate down, which is then going to make you look less funded, right? But it's going to allow you to take that risk off the table, if that makes sense. It's a little sometimes counterintuitive for people to understand. Page 25, dynamic, two methods employed to analyze strategy. Stress testing, which we're going to look at, and Monte Carlo simulation of future events. So page 27. So how does that work? So your traditional allocation is the blue line, and your dynamic is the green line. So it's not that you still don't go down. You can see that you still go down with the green line, but you don't go down as much. So when you employ a dynamic allocation, you're not going down as much as you would be when you employ more of a traditional allocation. And you can see the liabilities are there still sort of jumping up there. Page 28. Again, the traditional versus the dynamic. As the traditional, you can see in the up times, your traditional doesn't, its funded ratio doesn't go up as high as the other one. You see there in the beginning period. But then when it drops, it doesn't drop down as much as the other one.
So what's the negative to dynamic asset allocation?
There's not really a negative to it necessarily. I think it takes more vigilance on the part of a board to be watching that funded ratio and watching it go up. The thing with dynamic asset allocation is that it's, you have maybe more levers or more things to do when you're more well-funded. When you're underfunded, you still have to...
Who decides on the asset allocation during these periods? Is it the board? Is it you?
Well, I'll bring you mixes that dial down the risk. So what you're going to say is, you're going to say, okay, say we're 55% funded now. When we get to 65% funded, we want to look at the models, Rose. Bring us 5 or 6 options. We want to dial back the risk. And so I would bring you multiple ones, we would dial. And then when we get to 75, okay, Rose, that's a trigger point. Bring us, we're going to, and you could set that in policy, that at each of these points, you're going to want to dial back the risk. Now, when you get to 100% funded, you can do LDI. Can't really do LDI when you're underfunded. So what LDI is you're going to take, you're going to say, okay, I'm 100% funded. My liabilities equal my, you know, what I need to pay out, right? So my liabilities, so I'm 100% funded, completely funded. The only thing the city has to pay is the normal cost, right? So they just have to pay the normal cost of the plan. So what do? I say, okay, you were hired, you're going to retire in 30 years, the return stream's going to look like this. I'm going to buy a bond that's going to equal your return stream. So I'm going to completely, basically indemnify the program, take all the risk off the table, and just ladder it out over time. Now, some people say, well, you know, you're giving up all that return, you know, you could be earning all these, you know. And then, you know, everybody else says, well, I don't have to think about it. I don't have to think about it anymore.
Right.
The point of the plan is not to make returns. Right. The point of the plan is to pay benefits. Mm-hmm. And if the point is to pay benefits, then we should set it up such that we never have to worry about paying the benefits if we're 100%. Unfortunately, we're in a position where we're not 100% funded. When you're not 100% funded, ALM, LDI says you have to take more risk because you have to get back to that point. You have to earn, actually, when you're underfunded, you actually have to earn more than your 7 to get back some of that, right? So that's what you're doing there. So 29, people didn't worry about dynamic asset allocation. You preached it and preached it and preached it to pension plans, and nobody cared because the returns were so great. Why did anybody care? They said, well, the differences are minimal. Why do we care? So people care now more because they've gone through these times. But, you know, it's important. It's as important now as it was then, and, you know. And so 29 just sort of shows you portfolio weight. So as you go through time, this is sort of what it would have looked like as you put more equities, take more equities off the table. Prices will fluctuate. Monte Carlo simulations. So pension fund investing is complex. Okay, you have capital markets. You've got to look forward-looking, not backward-looking. It really doesn't matter what has happened historically. It really doesn't. I mean, you can use that as some base to try to forecast forward, but really what we want to know is what's going to happen in the future. Because what happened in the past is not going to get you returns today.
It's the past.
So, yeah.
Well, so years ago, they used to go by the past because there were trends. What was happening in 08, there were no trends for that. So anything going forward is all new. It's unrealized experience. So you can't go with the past now. I mean, forget it. There's nothing to look at and see, well, what was the norm back then? You know, it's...
ALM is a quantitative tool which can help the fund assess their risk-reward decisions in metrics which have meaningful impact to the plan, right? So we use a forecasting valuation model. We look at the liabilities. Now, you've never done a formal ALM study, okay? They cost money. And there's a lot of work involved. They take all your actuary data. They replicate the actuary data. It's a big... If you want to do it, we can price it for you. I don't know it's necessarily necessary, so that's something you can talk about yourself. But, I mean, we have a full ALM team that could do an ALM study for you if you want it. But I'm going to talk about, you know, ALM and what it does. Page 32. So it's gonna do trials. It's gonna do, you know, page 33 sort of shows it more. It's gonna take thousands of samples. It's gonna look at future trends. It's gonna input, and then on page 34, you're gonna basically get a normal distribution, and it's gonna tell you about outcomes, right? And so what you're really trying to do with ALM, let me use the board, is. So with ALM, what you're trying to do is, okay, so if we want to be here, and we could, you know, there's risk, right? So our risk is we could be from here or to here with, say, whatever probability, right? We're going to be here. All these tail events can happen, try to bring in the tails, but we say with 90%, we're going to be in here, right? And so say this is maybe a 7% return, right? What ALM wants to do is they want to bring it in, right? Say within a 90% certainty, I won't say guarantee, but within parameters, you're going to be somewhere between 3% and 10%, right? And, you know, before, you were going to be between -3% and 15%, right? So you're trying to bring in the probability of a bad outcome, right? You're trying to bring it in and look at the probability of you doing poorly or even better, and you're sort of bringing it in. So
basically, it gives us the probability that we're going to reach our goal.
Right.
Am I correct?
That's right. And they look at funded ratios. So they're going to say the probability that in 10 years your funded ratio is going to be 50% or 100, like what is that probability, and they can bring it in for any specific asset allocation that you choose. Page 35. So traditional, so as you can see, there's more outcomes. You see that gray sort of there for the traditional. And then dynamic, like I said, it's bringing it in and trying to get you to be more certain of what the outcomes are going to be for your funded position, right? Trying to bring the tails in. So some questions. Is it market timing? No, it's not market timing because you're still setting a long-term asset allocation. Now, people talk about tactical moves. Bernie's talked about tactical moves. What you really want to do from a tactical point of view is you set your long-term asset allocation, and then from a tactical perspective, you have ranges around those targets, right? And you'll see me present that on a quarterly basis. So say your target to equity is 30%, but your range is, say, 20 to 40. If you think equities right now is at a high point, or you think it's going to underperform, then you underweight that a little bit within your range. You don't make huge tactical moves, but you underweight in real estate. Like right now, I think is a very good time for real estate. You have a target of 12% of real estate. I would say right now, you should overweight your real estate allocation. It's done very well. value-added and opportunistic real estate are in good positions to continue to make money for the next. So you could overweight that asset, not overweight it to 30% if your target's at 13 for long run, but you can overweight it to 15-16% and underweight. And that's how you, on a tactical basis, you know, do well. But plan to do well over the 20-year, 30-year time horizons are the ones who stick to their long-term asset allocation and don't do things where they go to cash. You know, they say, oh, we think we hit, you know, we're going to take everything off the table and go to cash. None of the statistics show that that has been helpful, that people don't get whipsawed. You know, you might figure out the time to get out, but you don't know when to get back in.
It's two decisions.
Right.
It's when to get out and when to get back in.
Right.
You can't do it.
Yeah.
And the one to get out is real easy. You feel there's a right on the bottom.
I mean, you're
totally, you don't know when to get, you don't know when to get back in. It's going to go lower, it's going to go lower, and that's this whipsaw.
Right.
Whipsaw business.
More questions here. Will you have a larger positions in bonds? Probably over the long term. But if you see short term, like I was looking at your portfolio and I might bring you some mixes if that's what you want me to do in like a month. Infrastructure, there's some infrastructure funds out there that have done fairly well. Not MLPs, if that's what you're thinking, but actual institutional quality infrastructure funds that have done green, focus on green things that have done very well. That might be somewhere to enhance your fixed income allocation. Those are all implementation things. This presentation is really big picture. And then from an implementation, obviously you want me to bring you the best managers in each class. We need to make sure those managers are performing well. And then if we do have bonds where we're not sure it's going to be a lower performing asset classes, what can we do on the short run to maybe enhance that a little bit? Not a lot, but with things we can do. And that's why you have a core plus fixed income manager, so he can get a little bit more, those kind of things. And then I think the last, I got 2 minutes, but this is all on bonds. So Bond, James Bond. Dan runs our ALM practice, so he helped me with this presentation. He's very quirky. He has an actuary background. But this is, says, well, what about bonds? Are they really going to be terrible and be negative? And so this goes through that. What do bonds look like? Page 39. Yields are low today. What does that look like? We don't try to predict interest rates. Anybody who does, we don't think they can do it. So we don't say we think interest rates are going to necessarily go up or go down. We run scenarios in both ways. We feel like bonds are still over the 20-year going to return about what we think, which is around 4.5%, which is already in your model. So remember, the model that I presented to you a year ago, 2 years ago, had all those factors in it. Page 40 shows you some different companies and their bonds, the bonds for those companies, and how, you know, what the yield is, yield to maturity on those bonds. So they're around in the 4% range. Page 41, overweight corporate bonds, underweight treasuries, which, you know, that's why you hire a bond expert. You've got two really good bond experts. You've got Double Line, which is Gumlock, who's, you know, one of the best bond guys in the country. And then you've got Pyramus, which is Fidelity, basically, and they've done amazing for you over time. So you've got two really good bond people. And they do all of this, but this is just to sort of show you about bonds. And we'll stick there. And then 47, real estate is liquid until you need it, and we saw that. So that's why real estate's not 30 or 40% of your portfolio, but having some of it is important, and it has done well for you over time. And we just have to make sure, and we always do this in your asset allocation, is to make sure we don't have too many assets in there that are illiquid, because you need to be able to access that money. And I think that's basically it. So I think I stayed within my time. They're going to call me and Alicia, and what they're going to talk about is I asked them to talk about options, trading, and what they've done for other clients in the options world. So they're going to talk about that and have what that looks like. And then they're also going to talk about, they have an equity hedging product. Okay, it's just a product for U.S. equities, and they use hedging within it. So at first they're going to talk about options, which is the first one. It says it should say options, and then they're going to talk about their defensive equity product after that.
So are we suggesting a portion of the portfolio?
Well, options is like a well, options trading is has typically an overlay to your equity portion of your portfolio. So they're going to talk about that, and then we can talk about that afterwards. If you wanted to do defensive equity, that would be a portion of your portfolio, a small part of it. If you wanted to try that product.
Good morning.
Morning.
Morning. This is Rose. How are you?
Rose, doing well. Despite the impending polar vortex hitting the upper Midwest, so if you tune into the Vikings-Seattle game on Sunday, you'll see how crazy the people are up here.
That is crazy. Arnie left the room for a minute. I don't know. We might want to wait until Arnie gets back. And I had, is that Chris that I'm talking to?
That is Chris. We also have Vishy McDonough and Greg Bauer on the line as well. But unfortunately, you'll mostly be hearing my nasally Midwestern accent.
Okay.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And so, Chris, we had talked before, so and I had prepped the board a little bit that we'll go through the options presentation first. And go through that, and then we'll talk about defensive equity after that.
Sure.
And just, I hadn't told the board, but I had given them about 30 minutes for formal presentation, and then about 15 or 20 minutes for questions.
Sure.
I don't know if we should wait for Arnie's not back yet, so we're going to wait a couple minutes.
Yeah, that sounds good. If you want to put us on mute or, you know, whatever, we'll start whatever is convenient for you guys.
Okay. All right, Arnie just entered the room. If you could do quick introductions, who's on the phone, and your maybe title, a little bit of background of the people on the phone, and then you can go into the presentation.
Sure. So, hi Arnie and the rest of the board. This is Chris Uhas at Parametric. I am the head of business development at Parametric. I'm based in Minneapolis. You'll probably detect a bit of a different accent than what you're used to. I have been with the company for about 8 years. My specialty is talking about derivative-based applications with plan sponsors like yourself as it pertains to managing exposures and risk in portfolios. At Parametric, you know, most of my interactions are with pension plans, endowments, and foundations. The bulk of my conversations deal with some type of you know, question as it pertains to risk or a concern that plan sponsors bring up, and the conversation we'll have today is very similar to those I have with, you know, with dozens of plan sponsors on a daily basis. I'm joined by Mishi McDonough, who is the Managing Director of Consultant Relations at Parametric. She's based in Boston. You know, she is responsible for our interactions with folks at Siegel Rogers Casey. It's typically the first call that folks like Rose make is to Mishi to you know, flush out resources that we need to apply to client and plan sponsor questions. And Mishi, if you want to add anything else, feel free. I'll quickly introduce Greg Bauer as well, my colleague who's based in Atlanta. And Greg covers the southeast region, including Florida, for the firm, the Parametric.
Could I ask for the academic background on the individuals you just listed?
Sure. So, again, this is Chris. I've got a Bachelor's of Science in Electrical Engineering from the University of Notre Dame. Who got shortchanged in the Fiesta Bowl against Ohio State. I've got kind of a pseudo master's degree in nuclear engineering. I was a United States submarine officer for 5.5 years, and I have an MBA from the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business.
Oh, and for myself, I have, you also have your CFA, your Chartered Financial.
Yes, professional designation.
As for me, I went to Emory University quite a few years ago. Got my bachelor's degree, have my MBA from Babson College up here in Massachusetts. I have my chartered financial analyst designation as well as my chartered alternative investment analyst designation. So.
This is Greg Bauer. I graduated from Brown University with a bachelor in economics and then graduated from Georgia Tech for my MBA and also have my CFA and CAIA as well, similar to Nish.
And my apology for not looking at the biographies, but you all were certainly not ashamed to go ahead and give us your credentials.
We kind of have some expensive pieces of paper hanging on our wall. Okay, well, maybe what we'll do is I'll spend just a quick minute on the firm, and then we can launch into the presentation. At any point in time, please feel free to stop me and ask any questions. So again, the firm is Parametric. If you have the presentation in front of you or up on a screen, we're going to be kind of referencing the presentation entitled Equity Hedging Through Options. And starting on page 4, there's a quick overview of who the firm is. Parametric is a money manager that is headquartered in Seattle, Washington. We have 3 offices in the U.S., Seattle, Minneapolis, Minnesota, and then in Westport, Connecticut. You heard me state that I work out of Minneapolis. My colleague Mishi's out of Boston. There's a good reason for that. And Greg Bauer works out of a home office in Atlanta. Parametric is a majority-owned subsidiary of the Eaton Vance Corporation, which is headquartered in Boston. So we have a number of Parametric employees who office out of their location in downtown Boston. Eaton Vance purchased the majority of Parametric back in 2003. It's been a nice relationship, but Eaton Vance is a very different type of money manager, so they let us run our operations the way we see fit. Parametric is a manager that is not in the business of forecasting markets or securities. We're not an active manager in the traditional sense, so we can't tell you where we think markets will be tomorrow or a year from now or 10 years from now. We essentially discount active market views and take a more pragmatic, what we call engineered approach to portfolio construction. We manage about $150 billion for about 400 institutional investors in the U.S. Of our $150 billion, about $100 billion of that is for peers of yours in the private and public pension space, endowments, and foundations. We have been here in Minneapolis, where roughly half of our assets are managed, about $75 billion, been in the business of implementing derivative-based programs. You'll hear me use the word overlay from time to time, and I'll define what that means in a bit. But in Minneapolis, we tend to help plan sponsors implement exposures, essentially adding, removing, or hedging some type of market risk. We're dealing typically with an issue that the plan sponsor or consultant views as one that needs to be addressed, and we do so through separately managed accounts. The word derivative tends to have a very negative connotation in the market. My hands are sweating just when I say it. But we are not speculators. We essentially run an extension of staff or extension of consultant type of model, where our clients and consultants with whom they work express a concern about a risk or some issue or inefficiency that they would like to deal with. And our job is to come back to them to provide a number of alternatives as to how they can implement some strategy that is designed to tackle or deal with that risk. Sometimes very costly, sometimes not, but essentially it's the decision of our plan sponsor clients and their consultants as to what they want to do. Our job is to ultimately implement that. We have 30 years of experience in operating in these markets on a global scale, So part of the value that we bring to a client relationship is a deep understanding of how these markets work, how instruments are priced, how to implement them in the most efficient and cost-effective manner. We give our clients a lot of rope. We hope that they don't wind that around their neck, but we like to think that we add a number of additional tools to the investment toolbox, and we stand ready to help our clients understand how to utilize those tools. Are there any questions about the firm before I move on?
No, Chris, I think I would move on to page 11 and start going through the
programs. Sure. So we'll talk about equity hedging. As we, in our discussions with Rose, and she did a nice job of setting the stage here, as we look at page 11, the word overlay real quick. You know, most of what you have to deal with as plan sponsors at a committee on a daily basis is to evaluate and understand an investment manager's strategy. If you like it, you allocate money to him or her. They subsequently invest it, are given a benchmark, and are trying to manage a basket of securities to typically outperform some representative index. As an overlay manager, you know, we are given some type of concern or risk by the client, and we manage typically a derivative portfolio. These are not physical securities, but instruments that represent market exposure, and they can be added to or overlaid on top of a portfolio so that the economic performance of the instruments that we manage will complement or adjunct the physical security portfolio, so that ultimately your cash portfolio plus the strategy that we manage gets you your desired outcome. As it pertains to managing equity risk, over the years, dozens if not hundreds of investors have come to us to say, hey, listen, we've had a great run in the market. We think that times might be changing. The markets might be starting to flatten out or hopefully not go down. But if they do, we'd like to, you know, hopefully get some relief, you know, from that. So how can we address that risk? Options are instruments that are typically thought of first and foremost when managing risk. It is insurance at its core, just like all of us buy homeowners insurance, automobile insurance, and in most cases, life insurance. It provides relief when there are negative events or outcomes in the market. There are good reasons to utilize these types of instruments. Many of our clients in the pension space might be managing surplus risk. They have funding requirements, and below a certain level, bad things happen. They might have balance sheet considerations if they're a corporate pension plan. Some express capital market views. Most of our clients, most institutional investors, are not in the business of market timing or forecasting markets. We certainly are not, but we work with investors who believe they have that skill, and we enable the ability for them to implement those views. Some clients have very short investment horizons, 1, 2, 3, 6 months. Some event may be coming up, financial statement risk, insulating the pension plan assets, and they wish to essentially immunize the movement of their underlying equity portfolio, and options may be a very nice tool to do that. Okay? But essentially, you know, you're getting paid to take risk in the market, and in exchange for your willingness to take on that risk, you're expecting to earn long-term positive risk premium. Options, in looking to try to reduce that risk, you'll hear me say a couple times that with lower expected risk, you should expect lower return. There's going to be no silver bullet that we're going to communicate to you today. If you turn to page 12, one benefit of using some type of overlay program is it is non-disruptive to a plan structure. So you can keep all your managers in place, all your asset allocation, on the side or on top of the portfolio. We have plan sponsors that will implement some type of overlay strategy that is generating you know, a hopefully positive return when markets are heading south, if that is their goal. and it's offsetting losses in the physical portfolio. But at no time is it disruptive to the physical portfolio, which is nice. It can remove the requirement for trying to time the market. This is really, it deals with the finesse or art of implementation. We can be many times very targeted with addressing the specific risk that our clients have defined for us. So in the case of equity risk, many times we can match up some type of option overlay with the benchmarks or benchmark of the equity portfolio that you have. And it can fit well with the very limited time horizon. So some clients tell us, hey, over the next year, I would like to essentially buy some protection, as it were, and we can match up the strategy that we manage with those time requirements. I'm going to move forward to page 14 as we try to just illustrate at a high level how these option contracts, as we call them, work. You'll see two graphs on page 14. There are two basic types of options, a put option and a call option. A put option gives the buyer the right, but not the obligation, to sell an asset at a predetermined price at a predetermined time. This is the central instrument to any type of protective strategy. Perhaps in your personal portfolios, or you've heard on TV or read in the press, that if one is looking to get some relief from negative events in the market, that one is purchasing a put option. To throw some kind of numbers at this, let's say the S&P 500 index closes at 2,000, or is at 2,000 today. If you're concerned about the market dropping, say, 10%, or dropping in excess of 10%, one could go buy a put option that is, as we say, struck at 10% below the market level over, say, a six-month time period, and that insurance contract essentially will start to pay you money, dollar for dollar, to offset any losses in the S&P 500 if that index were to drop more than 10%. They're highly customizable instruments where we can determine the exact time over which those contracts are functioning, as well as the specific index level at which that protection, as it were, kind of kicks in. That's a put option. On the other side of the table is something called a call option, functionally similar to a put, but instead of the obligation to sell an asset at a specific time and price, it's the rights but not obligation to buy an asset at a certain time or price. So many times investors will buy call options to get participation to the upside, to enhance returns. These instruments are used in conjunction with each other to create various types of protective structures. And if you turn to page 15, this is one structure that we in the market refer to as a collar, where an investor is buying a put option, seen on the left side of that graph. And you can see a shaded area in there. On the top there's a dotted line that says hedge. So an investor in this case is buying a put option, which has a defined cost, just like any insurance contract would. And in order to pay for that insurance, the investor is selling a call option. They're essentially saying that they're willing to sell away a certain amount of upside to finance that insurance. It's called a caller because the investor is essentially collaring or defining bounds around their equity portfolio that will, beyond which they will not participate in the market at all. This is a commonly used structure called a caller that we have implemented in the past for investors. Maybe I'll just stop there and see if there's any questions before I push forward. Okay. Let's talk about the call. cost of these instruments, because like most insurance contracts and insurance world, you know, insurance is not free. And I will continue to hammer the point home that equity options are financial insurance, and it's really economically no different than homeowners insurance, life insurance, or automobile insurance. There are organizations who are willing to sell insurance to most of us that either have to or want to buy insurance. And insurance companies are not in the business of losing money. Over time, insurers, for their willingness to underwrite risk, demand and are entitled to a reasonable rate of return for or in exchange for selling these instruments. When we buy homeowners insurance, we don't expect over the life of us owning homes to walk away with money in our pocket from buying that insurance. There will be events where a home burns down or is flattened by a hurricane where the insurance company pays the $300,000 of the value of the home to replace it in the case of an event. But the insurance companies are smart in that they have very extensive models to determine what price they will charge for those insurance contracts, so that at the firm level across an entire book of insurance, they are essentially on a year-to-year basis taking in a little bit more insurance premiums than they are paying out to their insurance clients. And this financial insurance market is no different. Instead of insurance premiums, say for hurricane insurance, maybe use a prescient example for your home state, when there are a rash of hurricanes, hurricane insurance prices go up. And in the financial insurance market that we're talking about today, when markets go down and the volatility in the market goes up, the price of these instruments also goes up. There will be times where you have purchased, say, hurricane insurance, and a year later, hurricanes come through and you're going to collect on that insurance. And there are times in the financial insurance market where you will buy financial insurance on your portfolio and bad things happen, and you'll get a payment from this insurance. But over the long term, one does not expect to end up profiting by buying insurance. That is really kind of one of the first takeaways that you've heard me say nothing else today, is that insurance is not free. And over the course of, say a market cycle over a multi-year period, one should expect to reduce overall returns to the portfolio by engaging in buying insurance. And you may be very, very fortunate in terms of timing, or have some inane ability to time markets, but generally speaking, our experience in running these types of portfolios for three decades tells us that investors who wish to buy insurance are really going to be diminishing portfolio returns. Any questions about that?
Okay. I have one. So you kind of beat around the bush. So let's use this week as an example.
Yeah.
So now that China has had two circuit breaker operations and the market's starting to decrease a little bit, how do you say your rates have gone up? Because obviously they've gone up this week versus last week, right?
Yes.
So can we just, like, for mathematical, let's say if we had a $200 million asset, what would the insurance have been last week versus this week?
Yeah, so put some numbers on this. Very good question. So on December 31st, if you would have said, hey, we are interested in buying over a one-year time period, a put option struck 10% out of the money, you would have paid at initiation a little over 4% for that. So if you would have bought on $200 million of 1 year, as we call it, 10% out of the money put, you would have written a check for about $8.5 million. And we find ourselves 2 weeks later, that has gone up in price by roughly 50%. So today, the cost to buy that same insurance contract would be closer to $13 million. Said another way, if you would have bought that for $8.5 million on 12/31 today, you could sell it for $13 million and put a nice $4.5 million profit in your pocket. The issue with that is that, number one, nobody knew on December 31st that 2 weeks later the markets were going to be lower. So you would have, up to that point, had to collectively come to the decision, all right, hey, we're willing to reduce the portfolio returns over the next year, not knowing what markets are going to do. We're going to reduce portfolio returns, or returns on $200 million by 4.5%, or a little over 4%, 4.25%, which is probably more than half of what your assumed rate of return is for the entire plan. Number two, you bought this insurance contract, which is good, if you will, the tenor, as we call it, over a one-year period. And 2 weeks into the term of that contract, markets have started to move south, and they've gone down 7 or 8%. You said, wow, this insurance is great. It's gone up in value, and now we have the potential, if we sell it now, 2 weeks into this 52-week contract, we could pocket $4.5 million. Well, that's an active decision. Do you, at that point, say, we'd let it ride, hold on for another year, and maybe by the end of the year the markets are higher, at which point that option and contract expires worthless? Or you monetize that contract and pocket the profit, and the markets fall another 20 or 30%. We just don't know what's going to happen. So what we counsel our clients to do is say, well, listen, you need to buy into an insurance program as a strategy, right? Continue to fund this. You need to allocate a budget of 50, 100, 200, 400 basis points per year and assume that you are always going to have this in place and implement such a program so that you ladder these contracts, which expire on some regular periodicity, say quarterly, where there are natural points at which various pieces of the option portfolio are expiring, so you can mechanically harvest gains or take losses and then reset the next set of options that you're going to buy. Essentially, when you are engaging in buying insurance, you have to get two decisions right: when to put it on and when to take it off. And nobody knows if you're going to get both of those or neither of those right. The short answer, and I struggle with short answers, I apologize, it's a known character flaw. Right now, the premiums are about 50% higher than what they were 2 weeks ago. They're never cheap. I don't care if it's 2007 and volatility's at a multi-decade low, or it's either the financial crisis. Insurance is always expensive. It's the degree to which it is expensive. It could be a little expensive or it could be a lot expensive. But on an ex-ante basis, before we have the benefit of looking back over some horrible event and critiquing it like a Monday morning quarterback, we just don't know what's going to happen. And so those that are willing to engage in selling these instruments, acting like the insurance company, are the ones that benefit from the market's overpricing these instruments. The market, on a forward-looking basis is always overestimating the probability of bad things happening in the market, and that's reflected in option prices historically trading meaningfully above their quote-unquote theoretical value. If we all had perfect clarity as to what markets were going to do, options would be priced a heck of a lot lower than what they are right now.
Chris, can you just go over quickly, because we probably should move into the defensive equity presentation, Could you just go over the examples on maybe page 32, 33, so that it's a concrete example of what a client has done?
Yes. So, 32 shows, this is what we call an optional premium matrix. So this lists prices across different, as we call, tenors or terms. You'll see 3, 6 months, 1 year, and 2 year. And then across the horizontal axis, you'll see on the main left-hand side, put option premium. And those numbers from minus 35 to zero represent how far out of the money or lower than today's current market level these option premiums are. Now, it's a relatively old version, and I can speak to current pricing on this, but it's not all too dissimilar from what it is today. Our clients will use this as a rough tool to say, listen, I'm willing to participate in, say, the first 10% of market downside. I know, you know, it's analogous to having a deductible on your health insurance. You pay the first 10%. At that point, over a one-year period, I want to buy a put option struck at 10% below the money. And on this page, it's that box is shaded, and it says 5.05%. So you're going to write a check for 5% if you just buy a put option out 1 year, 10% below the money. And that means that you have a 10% deductible, but then after that, the insurance company ends up paying all of your losses. That's an exorbitant amount of money, because you never know if the market's going to, at 1 year later, be down more or less than 10%. But your break-even, so to speak, is the first 10% that you participate in the market, plus you got to earn the 5% that you paid. So the market has to drop more than your moneyness, as we call it, the 10% out of the money, plus the premium that you paid. So you don't start to get, quote, relief until the market drops more than 15%. And then you get protection for all of the market going all the way to zero, which is nonsensical because if the market goes to zero, we're all moving back into caves, and you're never going to collect on this anyway. So at some point, it makes sense to say, you know what, I don't need to be paid anymore because it's beyond the realm of possibilities that the markets go to zero. So while some clients, and we typically recommend this, hey, you know what, sell another put option, start further on money to essentially cap the amount of downside protection you get. That's the second shaded box there, shown in the minus 30% box. And that's the money that you can collect back to defer the cost of your long put, that your, the put that you purchased, we call a long put. And that 1.54% will defray the 5.05% cost that it ends up costing you roughly 3.5%, and you then get an insurance contract, if you will, where the deductible is 10%. You eat the first 10% or participate in the first 10% downside. Then you're insulated or insured for any market losses between down 10 and down 30, at which point there's no more insurance. So you get a 20% relief if the market's down, say, 50%. It is costly to do that. It helps people sleep well at night. But in a market that has been straight up for 6 or 7 years, I think the general, we're not in the business of forecasting, but the general the consensus out there is that we're not expecting 15, 20% returns. We're expecting more like 7, 8% returns if we're lucky. Why would one want to give up half of that expectationally, just in case the market drops 50? Now, the market could drop 50 tomorrow. We'll be the first to admit that. But we deal in expected outcomes, and we don't expect, if one buys insurance, to ever generate a profit from it. Questions on that? So we're about 35 minutes into this right now. They've either shocked everyone into traumatic silence.
Chris, let me ask you real quick. Obviously, paying the premium, we could do that with collars. Can you get into collars?
I can. So if you look at the same page, 32, okay, you could this example where you buy the minus 10, as we call it, and sell the minus 30 to get this 20% downside insurance contract. That's going to cost explicitly 3.5%. You know, 5.05 minus 1.54 is 3.5%. Now, you can either write a check for that, or you could implicitly pay for that by selling a call option. So one way to do that is to say, all right, well, if we didn't want to pay anything except for upside, where would I look? I could go and solve for the call option that I would sell that would generate an equal and offsetting amount of option premium. And that 3.5%, let's say, is right in between on the call option side. It's between 5 and 10% up. So it's not quite linear, but let's assume it is. So you say, all right, I'm going to sell a 7.5% out-of-the-money call option. Now you have a structure that we call a put spread collar, and the nice thing here is that, number one, you don't have to write a check at initiation. Number two, you get some upside participation. But number three, what ends up happening is in a market that, say, does go up 20%, you get to participate in the first 7.5% of that, and then after that, the call option, because you've sold it, is generating a loss which offsets underlying market movements in the S&P 500 beyond that point. If you feel strongly that, hey, you know what, markets are only going to go 5 or 7%, and so you're willing to sell a 7.5% out-of-the-money call option, that may fit with your views. What we have found over time is at when you tear apart these options and you look at the pricing, all these different variables that go into these big equations, everything is a known quantity that goes into the equation, with the exception of the estimated volatility of the stock market or the S&P 500. Just like State Farm says, hey, well, how many hurricanes do we think are going to roll through Florida next year? And they say, well, we think there's really going to be 3. And in their model, they say, well, we'll put 4 in to overestimate the damage, and they price their insurance contracts as such. Each one of these options has an estimate for volatility embedded in it. And that really is how we look at the true cost of these instruments. On the put option side, you're buying hurricane insurance. And the embedded volatility assumptions for put options are much, much higher than they are for call options. So option traders, people that do this for a living, don't talk in terms of prices. We talk in terms of volatility. And by buying volatility on the put side, which is egregiously overpriced, you are then selling volatility in call options, which is much, much lower. The net result is that you're still taking a what we call long position in volatility, which is a forward-looking estimate of what the market's going to do, is historically about 90% of the time overpriced. I hope I didn't confuse anybody with that. Mechanically speaking, one issue with using collars is that in order to utilize exchange-traded options, to sell a call as you would contemplate, the exchange requires that investors are in possession of what's called quote-unquote good collateral. Commingled vehicles, index funds are not good collateral. In order to do this efficiently, you would either have to be holding exchange-traded funds, ETFs, or have separately managed equity accounts, or you'd have to transact in a margin account, which is something we would not recommend doing. Because that means then you're having to actually physically post margin with a third-party broker, and you're exposed to potential credit risk of that entity. So functionally, smaller investors that tend to utilize commingled vehicles more just because they're more efficient have historically had issues implementing things like collars The alternative is to do things in the over-the-counter market, which is ridiculously administratively burdensome and presents a lot of legal headaches to and hoops to jump through. Rose, so we're at the 40-minute point, and I don't want to, I recognize you have other things to talk about, so I'll pause here, see if there's questions, and I'll take direction from you guys as to, I could talk for days. I don't want to, waste anyone's time. I don't want to continue.
Rose, what is our... the value of our equity portfolio, ma'am?
It's approximately, I wrote down some notes here earlier. I want to say it's approximately 40% of your portfolio, so, around $40 million, yeah. Yeah, 42%.
And obviously, Chris is unaware of how that, it's obviously not all U.S., some of it.
About half is international, half is U.S.
So if you're talking 20 million of U.S., 20 million of international equities, I take it you could put together an option strategy that would... protect us, say, after a 10% deductible, if you will, on a market downturn, and you could, I guess it would depend upon our portfolio of how those stocks are structured, and even put a collar on it with a call.
Mm-hmm. So there's two ways to approach this. Number one is the largest and deepest options market in the world is the one associated with the S&P 500 index. Very appropriate for your U.S. portfolio as a broad proxy. You might have the Russell 3000 as an index and have mid cap and small cap stuff, but a lot of our clients are saying, I'm going to use the S&P 500 because the U.S. markets all move in tandem. About $200 billion a day in S&P 500 options trade. When you look to overseas markets, there are very liquid markets for things like emerging markets and international developed as represented by the MSCI EAFE index. And using those in separately or in combination, one can kind of quote-unquote replicate indices like the MSCI ACWI index and whatever. We can get very granular on this. However, ostensibly you utilize equity managers who are active in nature, and there is some tracking differences between their performance and the underlying index. And so, we can't go out and look at a manager's portfolio and say, well, you know what, they don't own everything in the index, and they've got some active risk in there, and they generally are within 1 or 2% of the index. We can't hedge precisely their portfolio. We hedge index performance. Now, because of that, a lot of our clients will say, and the other factor is you get into things like, overseas markets, developed and emerging. The cost, if you will, the premium, as we call it, associated with these options is higher than it is with the S&P 500 market because the volatility assumptions are higher for overseas markets. Because of that, a lot of our clients just say, I'm going to use S&P 500 for everything. I'll make some assumptions about if our markets drop 10 or 15%, that probably means that overseas markets might drop another 5 or 10% more. And so they'll scale up or down or change that deductible point, if you will, and just utilize S&P 500 from an efficiency and cost standpoint. But the short answer, we can do this. Depending how those managers are structured in terms of the accounts, it may be very problematic for you to execute efficiently a caller.
I was going to say, based upon what you know, is just gross numbers and allocation of assets. So really, we would need to get into the numbers to see how this might work. But obviously, we're talking $40 million, not $200 million, as far as an equity portfolio. And of course, the concern is we don't want to be in a market timing business, but obviously you get to a point where you feel like you've done well, and if the market goes south, you just assume, you know, not give it all back.
I understand that sentiment. Exactly, and I wish that there was some free lunch out there. You know, the issue with that is that you espouse that concern, and 1,000 other investors are doing the same thing, and that in and of itself
is what drives the cost.
And so the market is smart, and these markets in particular change by the second. So the minute that there's movements in the market, over the last, you know, like I said, you know, markets are down 7%. These prices of these contracts have gone up 50% in just the last 4 days. And they could drop 50% in the next 4 days. We just don't know. But it's smart in that the market, it anticipates, for some reason, investor sentiment like this. And so, you know, expectationally, it is pricing these instruments so that you will never collect on these. Now, it might happen, right? You might buy homeowners insurance expecting 4 hurricanes and there's 8. But it's likely there's going to be 3. So as a fiduciary, you know, we would advise you to not buy insurance, because we would hate for you to you know, let's say markets go nowhere. You know, everybody breathes a sigh of relief. You know, if you structure it with a collar, you have no explicit cost from these instruments, but you're going to pay up $100,000 a year to do this.
Or your service is not gratis, I take it, then.
You know, at some point in my life, I will be doing God's work. I just haven't reached that point yet.
We're a public plan. It's God's work.
It's the $64,000 question. I feel for pension plans who have benefited nicely from the post-financial crisis performance of the markets, and a concern that, hey, a 50% drop gets us kind of back to, you know, that starting point. If one buys insurance, you may be very lucky. But the market, you know, as big a risk for you and your constituents is, you say, well, listen, we can't write a check for, you know, say 4% of 40, you know, we can't write a check for $1.6 million today to buy insurance. So we'll sell our way upside. We'll collar this thing, as we call it. And then something happens. Yellen does something everybody loves, and the Chinese get their act together, and the markets go up 20%, and guess what? You're up 7. And then there's questions. And we've been in that position with clients in the past, and it's not a fun scenario or situation for anyone involved.
So I take it in this space you do not recommend the collars.
We do not recommend collars at all. We would much rather see investors recognize that insurance, it's best to define your budget up front, write a check for it, and move on. At least then there is no opportunity cost that you may incur because the markets went a much different direction than the structure you purchased.
Yeah, again, you get into this, you know, this market timing business, which obviously with options we, so to speak, avoid, because you're still, if you do a put, you still hold the asset, but then you get to a point of again, if the market goes nowhere, we've had to pay you, we've had to pay the premium. But, you know, obviously this insurance is out there, and just like fire insurance, houses do burn down. And, you know, you just have to think, when something has gone straight up, at some point in time, the air is going to come out of it. You might be a little bit late in making that decision, you might be a little bit early in making that decision, but isn't it prudent to be thinking about it?
I would, your comments are spot on, and in our experience in discussions with consultants and plan sponsors, we believe that If an investor who holds equities, or any risk asset for that matter, feels that the risk has somehow changed, that now there's increased risk of holding that same asset relative to, say, 3 years ago, then at its core it becomes an asset allocation discussion. It doesn't make sense to rethink how our assets are allocated, because if the risk profile of, say, equities now is riskier, then maybe we need to allocate between, amongst, or out of equities into something else.
And that's what we talked about with the underweighting and overweighting within our ranges to our targets. If we are,
clearly.
Chris, you just tied right into everything I talked about before you got on the phone.
That is wonderful stuff. Maybe I will start doing God's work now.
Well, we're going to let you go because we're going to talk over time. So I appreciate you all calling in.
Sure. Enjoy the sunshine, folks. It was nice speaking to you.
Enjoy the snow in Minnesota.
I'm about to self-immolate.
So I wish there was a silver bullet, but as you can tell.
Oh, there isn't. I mean, you got to put it on and you got to take it off. You know, it's just an issue of you know, it's a taking off point, and obviously, you know, the underfunded status of the plan at this last FPPTA convention, you know. With some pretty bright people saying that DB plans may be history after the next market collapse.
But tell me, you know, I'm a little bit of a historian, but tell me when markets do go up, markets do go down, but tell me periods of time that they've never recovered.
Yeah, but you have to understand the mathematics of a pension plan. The reason we're having to put in as much as the payroll,
right,
is because the money is not there when the actuary does his calculations.
Right.
And then there are further dynamics in the plan, like the young people.
Yeah, I mean, if you run an ALM, and what I did, we actually did an ALM probably 3 years ago for a school system. So I consult to the Kansas City school system. And what happened, and you may have heard this throughout the country, some school systems, so they gave all the teachers out, they consolidated the schools, sort of like Detroit, you know what I mean? They went to one school, they had like five schools, they went to one school, they fired basically all the teachers, offered them early retirement. The plan went from, I think, 95% funded overnight to like 80% funded. And it wasn't like it was going to be 80 and then 81, like went to 80 and then it was going to be 78.
and it was going to keep going because you then, you went from a young plan, like I talked about, to a mature plan, literally overnight. And these people had never seen a funded ratio below 80%. They had always been really well funded. And so we did an ALM, and when you do an ALM, what the ALM will tell you is, what sort of Bernie is saying, at some point, you get to a point where, like Illinois and Kentucky, where they're 30% funded, if you have an event, you know, you're getting there where you have no money. If you have no money to make money on, then, you know, so that's those outcomes. And so but that's why you try to do this dynamic. That's why you try to be a little bit tactical on your rebalancing, and you try to do those things. And over time, those things have worked for people, and they've done well over time.
Can you price for us what a Monte Carlo simulation?
An ALM typically costs around $40,000. That's what it costs for our group to do it. I probably could get them to do it for you. You've been a client for a long time for around $30,000. Probably get like a, you know, push my guys to get a little discount, but that's typically what they, you know, out there they cost. So they do cost money. It's a flat fee, and they would do a whole,
now,
you know, ALM.
Where are we in terms of, you know, it's kind of, how do I express this? You are the investment consultant.
That's correct.
Now, we start bringing in George and Frank to provide us information. Okay, I would not really feel very comfortable being the investment consultant unless...
George and Frank?
I'm talking about the managers. I moved away from AI. Let me get back on AI. Let's say you would do it for 30, mm-hmm. but let's say I know two other guys that would do it for 15. Where does that fit into our relationship with you as the investor?
We would want you to have us do it. And I think we're very reasonably priced for an ALM study for you to look at everything for you.
And it's just like managers that we would have. You would want us
instead of me doing...
Otherwise, you wind up in a very difficult position.
Right. Well, the ALM is going to look at... Yeah, it's going to probably come out and recommend an asset allocation. But we just did an ALM for a public pension plan in Alabama. And I don't want to say it's like this insurance, but the ALM came through and it said you're doing what you're supposed to do.
May not be worth the money.
That's the thing is, and so what I'm saying to you is, I know how a lot of ALMs come out because I do them all the time. I work with the ALM team. I'm telling you, your ALM is going to say, maybe within a little whatever, that you're doing pretty good with what you're doing. But if you want to see it, I mean, it's a big presentation. If you want to see it with your liabilities and it remaps everything your actuary does, and it, I mean, I don't want to discount the value of it. I mean, my company would be like, Rose, you're not. Like, whatever.
But it's all statistical. So.
It's a lot of stats.
It's no different than when we see a hurricane come and all of a sudden you see all these different glide paths.
Right.
It's still statistical.
Right.
So.
And I don't want to say I wouldn't want to take your money. I just don't think that. You know what I mean?
So on the other side of it, I mean, my opinion real quick is, okay, let's say it's a 5% insurance policy. Well, we still write off the first 10% loss. So now it's cost us 15%, mm-hmm. right?
But again, there's 35% more, and when you're talking about how far.
But without an ALM, I still can do dynamic asset allocation. We can still set a policy. We can still put that policy in. I talked to my ALM team before I came here today, and I said, well, what are your thoughts? You know, they're very underfunded. You know, and he said, I really think that you should. I think you should set a policy with them that really would say, okay, because I was like, they're really concerned about risk. This is their concern. Risk is a big concern. He's like, I wish more clients were so concerned about risk. He says, I tell people all the time. And he says, really, if you develop the policy as the funding ratio increases that you're taking back that risk, he says, I think that would be a great policy for them to talk about and implement.
Let's talk about 208. when Arnie brought up the fact you meet four times a year and, you know, everything went down the toilet between meetings, so to speak. So can we, with a dynamic, kind of ameliorate that so that things will happen, so to speak, on autopilot based upon where we are from the last meeting? You follow what I'm trying to say?
So there's still the logistics. Let's say Rose says, my guy's detected, we're starting to, you know, change, things are changing.
Yeah.
We need to move things. It still takes all types of paperwork and signatures to make things start flowing. So it's still,
I mean, there's also the solution of discretionary consultant, right? And Arnie and you have been to, you've seen these presentations, but a lot of people are moving, pension plans are moving to outsource CIOs, where instead of me being your consultant, where I just come give you advice, you hire me to be, you give me discretion. Okay? So I can do anything. So I can sign, I can do everything. So if I detect 2 weeks in, I think stuff needs to move, I do it. Okay, that's expensive. Costs more than what I do now because I take a lot of fiduciary responsibility, more than I take now, but I can be more tactical, right? I can move stuff around and...
Within the framework that the board...
There's the whole liability. I mean, even if she misses the target by a week, and I mean, everything dropped 10%, she's not held accountable. We're just giving her the ability to be a little more liberal at how she deals with all the funds.
And again, I'd love to take your money, but I'd love to take your money, but I think that I don't know in 2008 that we would have done a huge amount differently. I think that our meetings that we meet quarterly, if you ever want to call a special meeting, I'll come. So let that be, or have a phone call with everybody. You can announce a phone call.
Well, see, there we go, right? Where are we with this, Alicia, really, in terms of being able to meet at the Sunshine Bar? See, that's...
Well, as long as she and I was
just an hour and 8 hours. Yeah. 72 hours to post a meeting.
Yep.
Our biggest hurdle is Lee.
Is what?
Lee Diener. Scheduling things with Lee Diener.
John, thanks for coming.
If you're comfortable with him not being there or being on a conference call, that's fine.
EPA? Are you going to that? Did you sign
up? And I'm sorry. Well, you were saying conference call now.
Lee is the biggest hurdle with getting a meeting scheduled.
Unless we did it, you said, on a conference call basis with
him. If he's available for conference call or without Lee.
Well, yeah, and sometimes we don't require Lee. Yeah. I mean, Lee is here for legal advice with some of the stuff we're doing as we start talking about money managers.
Yeah.
Tell us what's going on up in Tallahassee.
Right.
He's here for the legal guidance piece more than anything. And I don't understand why we can't use his daughter for certain things, too. I mean, is she not of that level?
No, I don't think she's at that level. And I need to read Lee's contract because it did come up in conversation earlier. Lee requires to be here at the meeting.
All right, so he got himself voted a raise every year, and yet it's still awkward to get a hold of him. If that's the case, then I think that he should be a little more obliged. I mean, he's got himself guaranteed, what is it, 3% raise every year?
I have to look at his contract.
I know, because remember, I was against everyone else, and I'm like, well, wait a minute. I understand Lee.
Take care. See you.
I'll talk to Lee about that.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, sure. John. Happy New Year again. Do we have to stop because we're not a quorum anymore?
No.
Can we continue the conversation?
As long as we're not a quorum.
I know Lee brings some stuff to the table, but I also know at times getting him motivated takes, you know, he doesn't respond to you, but I'll call, and then all of a sudden he'll jump through a hoop.
How about
Invesco?
But
we don't have that either.
Right. So what happens is, you know...
So why does that happen?
He's very busy. He consults the 230 public pension funds in the state of Florida.
He's a busy guy, and what he does,
he's
very busy.
I don't want confrontation, but I know, I've been saying for a while, I think it's time for our meetings.
So it happens, Bernie, just so you know, he drags stuff on and on and on. Alicia finally says, you know, I need some help. And of course, if I call him,
if you call him, it's spot on.
He always
spot on.
Right. Well, because he knows that we provide.
But I have email after email that I don't get responses to. You know, I was promised the Invesco and the Wells Fargo and an ordinance change before I left for vacation. Here it is, the 8th of January, and I still don't have that.
That's a problem.
That's three things that we voted on in November, and we still have.
We can save it for a meeting, which is coming up soon. But I'm thinking maybe we should go out and look for, you know, some other legal advice.
And I do believe Cindy will be sending you an email. She's sending it to all three chairmen because she's having an issue. Again, we don't have the ordinance. We'd like to get the custodian changed over. You know, they are issues.
I will say that he does, he does a lot. And I do work with some other lawyers in this state of Florida. I don't know if I would necessarily say that any of them are any better than Lee. But Lee does have expertise that no one else in the state of Florida does.
He is uniquely in a very niche
The other thing I think about also is we've asked him what his succession plan is.
Yeah.
And
there's a have one. For right.
Here.
If he doesn't have one, then we're not ready.
Well, what about his partner? What?
He's about, Christian is about his age. Yeah, so. And
well, that's why I was asking about his daughter.
His daughter doesn't have any initials or anything.
Nothing.
By her name when she wanted to write.
Isn't she an attorney?
What are you saying? She's not an attorney?
I don't think she's actually an
That's
attorney.
What I was questioning. I thought she might be an assistant or something, or have some sort of, you know.
Paralegal. Right. Paralegal. We'll have to ask him. Yeah. But, yeah. When Dale Adams asked him what his recession plan is, he said there isn't one.
I mean, there's no law firm in the state of Florida that knows public pension plans, but like that firm does.
Really Which is don't. Great, but if you can't get responses, how helpful is it?
Well, like I said, you know, it's like I kind of let it flow for a while. Alicia says, hey, it's getting late. We're not getting responses.
I asked for an ordinance.
I call his cell phone and he'll always respond.
And we still don't have that. Yeah.
So this is
the last summary plan description we had was in 2010. I asked for one in 12, 13, 14, 15, and I still don't have one. We don't have something out there that we can give our employees that says this is what your benefits are.
And we talk about educating our employees.
Right.
How do you educate them with six-year-old documents?
So,
especially when we had a huge change in 2013.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Is it that it's complicated? Is that the reason he's having problems? Is because it's...
I think he's
He writes the ordinances, so, I mean, we've got, I think there's 11 amendments to the one ordinance. And
I mean, don't, so I'm not here testifying that he's fast. Right. We all know, I know he's slow.
I was going to say, attorney's budget,
you know,
future on the fast.
The only thing that needs to happen is we need to address it in memo form to Lee. It says, straighten up.
Well, we can't even vote on that right now.
Yeah.
At the meeting, we can bring that back up. If you put it on the agenda, he'll see. We need to get some faster response times. And maybe...
From somebody.
Do we have a contract with him?
We do.
Hey Coral has similar problems as you.
Right.
Hey Coral.
Well, no.
Nate just a year ago was just like, Lee, you better fix it.
But my point is, if the two of them don't have a succession plan, and we know they're getting older, it's like time to give up a little bit of the bankroll and go hire a new attorney to start mentoring to take over the business.
Yeah.
And that they can write off residuals the rest of their life.
Partners. For sure.
But I mean, it's time for him to step up his game, give up a little bit of his bankroll.
That's right. No succession.
The only other thing to do is to sell the business, and then it goes to who?
But then who knows what quality of
Exactly.
Right.
So is there a way to search who else knows this kind of stuff in Florida?
There are a couple. We know a couple. Klausner would be one of them. Nolan would be another.
Some South Florida.
Mm-hmm. I believe in South Florida.
You know, all of these firms you're talking about are.
Pension.
I was going to make is participate in the Florida public pension.
Yes.
You know.
Yes.
And
make
I'm not. And please take this correctly. do you guys ever participate in the...
Yeah, we used to teach. We taught classes all the time, and I think they're going to have a booth there at the next one.
Chris, in all of, how many years have I been on this board now?
Four now?
Yeah, Larry Marino used to teach all the time, and then I stood at a booth for a long time.
So Bernie, it's really us just setting a date, paying. I mean, we pay for them to fly down, to stay, to rent a car. I mean, we pay what the expenses are and their time for a class. But my point is, I don't think we need the class.
No.
You know, and I don't know how to gear it towards the employees, because...
Right.
Some of them will resent it. This is a mandatory thing.
To HR's defense, there are things on the internet for the employees that regarding your 401, your 457.
They're naive. They're ignorant and naive.
There are things out there for them.
They just don't understand it. So because it's complicated, I mean, you walked in. I mean, what did you say? Your eyes opened up, right?
Yeah.
The basic stuff we're talking about, it's like, holy cow.
Yeah.
And I mean, Bernie's been on this for 4 years. I've been active. I mean, I've been coming in for years before I got on the board, but I bet you for 10 years now I've been active. And there's still so much stuff to understand and to learn.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a lot. And even people with investment background who come on the boards, I see very sophisticated investors, like they've made billions of dollars, like billionaires on boards. It's different. Do you know what I mean? It's not about investing in one asset class.
Correct.
It's not about equities. It's a completely different... And
then you have to understand that it's a pension plan.
Right.
And the mechanics of pension plan. That's what it is, too, how all of this fits together. It's just a completely different...
And I just commend you for having an educational meeting. There's lots of... that don't do that. It's so important.
Well, to me, it's also a time that we can get the board together and have kind of an open forum to talk and, you know, see if everybody understands where they're going and what's going on. I'm not sure if John gave me a look when I tried to explain stuff. I wasn't trying to talk down to him, but I wanted to make sure he fully understands all the anomalies and intricacies of making things happen. I mean, being a knee-jerk board is not a reality. I mean,
and I would think we've had some bright people on this board that have gotten off real quick. They have figured out.
Yeah, it's complicated.
May be more than I want to do. It's just kind of like, and I wanted to do the same thing that Arnie was doing when you talked about the plan that was fully funded, but would still have to deal with normal costs going forward.
Yeah,
I don't know if he would have not that it's a difficult concept to come to, but unless you know what normal cost is, you know. So again, there's a lot to this this picture here, I compliment everybody willing to participate.
And, you know, once a year you're supposed to go off for extra education, some advance. You're a city employee. We'll pay for your time and all. Bernie does it on his own. I mean, we'll put the bill for him to get to the school, pay for his hotel, pay for his meals. You know, we'll pay for that.
Sure.
But his time is on his own.
You're
comped by the city. I'm comped by the city.
Right.
So you got to commend him for still being here.
Sure.
You know,
4 years later,
you lose people.
And you heard me say it once. And it's going to be hard for you to understand. We're here for the plan, not the employees.
Right.
And believe me, at least I can tell you how many times.
The employees voted you in.
Right.
Yes, no. It's not about that.
The fiduciary is to the money and the plan.
Right.
Exactly.
And
it's not about the employees.
I've had to explain
that. And the plan has employee implications. And it also has City of Ocala.
Right.
And as Arnie said, we got to consider all that, because if we don't do it right, the city all of a sudden says the hell.
Oh, I know
we
have so listen, tell them we want.
So I have thought changing our rate of return when we went from 8% to 7.5%, because I know the implications immediately.
Sure.
The city has to pay more, and when they went and got their own outside actuary and investment consultant, and they froze the plan, they projected that the costs were going to go up to the city, but they were nowhere near close to what the city was expecting they were going to have to pay. But they already pulled the trigger. I mean, you know, there's certain things that you can't take back. Pulling a trigger, words out of your mouth, you know what I mean? It's like...
So,
Sorry, to your point, I just look at my, I'll be at FPPTA in June, so I don't know.
Well, when you say booth, you're talking about the annual conference, and I don't, the only ones I've gone to are trustees.
We sign him up instead of a gentleman on the fire board, just because one was, the last name was the only difference.
Right.
So we got that big stuff. Well, we have canceled his, and I told him that we had canceled it, and he said he didn't get a cancellation. And that's probably because we had to call in the cancellation.
Right.
To FPPTA. So, and then we only did that Monday, so that's probably why he hasn't gotten that cancellation yet.
Okay.
Actually, we changed the name too.
So we're canceling his class coming up?
Yes.
Okay.
We couldn't make a, we couldn't make a reservation at the hotel, and it already filled up before Christmas. So we went ahead and registered him, and we monitored for a little while to see if somebody would cancel or whatever. And the overflow hotel is not where the conference is.
Right.
So yeah, we just canceled everything.
Alright.
So is anybody going to this school?
No.
No.
Been there, there's a couple of years. I mean, there's other options that I think too.
Sure. What do you need to do? Once every 3 years, really? Isn't that it? Really, that's all you have to do?
The money's there for every year. It's like.
Yes, there's enough for everyone to go once a year in the budget. In years past, I haven't had to worry about if somebody went a second, I can pull a little money from here and there. Going forward, we have a budget that goes to council, so if there's changes, we have to do a resolution, it has to go in front of council, they have to approve it, so it is a little.
But what you did today actually counts as, like, from a legal requirement, what you did today counts as 2 hours or however long we were here as education.
So even like, when the city has the sunshine stuff, I mean, you know, that's quasi-training for this too.
Yes.
Because we are, right, yes.
Right.
So I mean, if you don't want to get up and go out of town, I mean, we still have enough stuff that happens. We usually, every other year, teaches something within close proximity you can go to.
His partner down in Lady Lake, they do something for fire.
Right.
And I think police, because, does Lee?
Lee actually does do something. Usually it's within an hour from here. And it's a 4 hour something.
Yeah, I've never gone to one of his.
And then there is some education for fire and police that the state puts on. That has been in October. I have heard that they are bringing back a second one that they usually do, and that's usually in the early part of the year, April, something like that. That pertains just to fire and police. They generally don't do very much. Unless something big has come out of legislation for general, but most of the time the legislation changes are fire and police.
And if you go to our client conference, that counts as education too.
Yeah.
We have a client conference once a year.
So I get credit for that?
Yeah. That's what I tell you. I've gone to theirs.
You ought to do a better job than your people of communicating that.
Okay.
Because I saw nothing about.
Well, you don't get credit to FPPTA, but you get
credit to the board for what you need for continuing.
Oh, okay.
So those that are certified for FPPTA usually have to go.
I'm with you.
Sorry, but you can still go and just not.
Yeah, but doesn't it say something in the ordinance? And of course, it's something I'm going to bring up before I forget. Remind me to bring that up. But isn't there something about you've got to go once during your term, and how long are the terms?
3 years.
3 years. Isn't there something that says?
Yes.
One time.
One time.
Okay. But what you're saying is you're funded for
once a year.
Once a
and
year.
And that's usually because you and I have the certifications. So
correct.
You have to go once
and
a
back
year.
When I was going to school for the certificate, you allowed it to go to,
yes.
You know, bank, because that's the way to really do it if you're going to do it.
Get it over and done.
Get it done and over with, yes.
Correct.
So I chose that I don't need the certificate. I need the education, but
yeah,
I don't need the certificate.
Yeah.
Her position requires it. But
I just want
to keep on learning. Well, I don't know. I might come over to the public side if there's an opening. because of my involvement. I mean, I know that I'm going to start taking more summers off.
That will require a CPPT.
But, you know,
my feeling is everybody that sits on this board, and probably the city manager, should go to the trustee school so that you have a handle.
But I think it should be here at least 6 months.
Right.
Well, sure.
Well, we've lost some and left. Open their eyes and they're like, no, I'm out.
I would agree with that.
But like you should stay on. But the longer people stay on a board, the better the outcome.
Yes.
The longer board, you know, the knowledge is, for me in my position, and I consult to 12 public pension plans and some union pension plans. The ones, you know, that have long-term, you know, you can really do a long-term allocation, and the knowledge keeps going.
If only the governing body would realize that.
Yeah.
You know, like in this instance,
you're right.
City Council. You know.
Mr. Ortiz is being submitted to council for the other appointed position.
Marty or his dad?
Marty.
Okay.
For the He's position a firefighter? Here? Yes. He's a firefighter.
So but he's a city employee.
Yes, you can do city employees, but what we were trying to do is get a firefighter that can come over on the general board, get a general employee that can go over to the fire
board. So Marty actually has a desire? I mean...
And he submitted an application.
So why is Randy having such a problem trying to get anyone to mentor? I mean, he can't even get an apprentice.
I think Cindy or John Zober approached or knew and asked. And he submitted an application.
You don't think he's being strong-armed into it, do you? Maybe. Because of his position? I'll go ask him. So he's a newer captain. He's young. His father made it all the way up into senior management in the fire department. He progressed pretty quick. But, I mean, he's not bad. But I'm wondering if he's taking on too much tasks only because he's new to the position and he doesn't know when to say, oh, I have enough stuff.
Yeah, so he's already spread thin.
Right, now that's my point. I mean, you know, it's like he's talking to me about wireless and fire stations and mobile data for the, you know, it's like he is deeply involved in a lot of stuff. And I wonder, due to the lack of maturity, if he's just taking this on, like I said, is he being strong-armed?
Somebody asked him, so he didn't feel like he was saying
that. Well, he doesn't know how to change.
Yeah, because he's progressed so high so fast.
Yeah, the city can appoint city employees.
They can appoint them?
Yes.
Well, they have to agree, don't they?
Yes.
Okay. All
well, right.
Voluntary position to be a trustee. Yes,
right.
It is voluntary.
Right.
Yes, but because we haven't had any applications, you know, I brought up that we had had other city employees appointed to the boards.
Mm-hmm.
We just tried to shop from the different pools. You know, try and get someone from fire police to come on the general and vice versa, you know, have fire on police or what have you.
Understood.
Because they're already, you know, we're already represented.
Right.
If you know a retiree that would be willing to, you know, Diane was the retiree for a long time.
I understand, but her heart was in it. I mean,
yes.
Big time, you know.
Yep.
Because she's been involved so long. But yeah, trying to find, I mean, Stan was the last public guy I remember that stayed for a while.
Yeah, I think he was 12 or 13
years. Yeah, and he was really good. I mean, he could lead a meeting real good. I mean, you know, I just ad-lib it, but I mean, we get past it. We correct me once in a while.
So this board should be full at the, hopefully, February meeting.
Okay.
I don't believe they'll get appointed until later in February. But I've asked them to come to the February meeting so that, you know.
Right. If I can ask you to put on the agenda for the meeting in February, we want to review our attorney and his response times and possibly go out, have a conversation about maybe going out. Maybe that'll open his eyes a little bit when he sees the agenda come to him. Or maybe he won't care, who knows, but if we put it in the agenda and then we'll discuss it in an open forum. With, you know,
I know they'll hurt his feelings.
Huh? We won't hurt his feelings?
We will.
You will.
But, well, then let a man up and, you know, respond a little faster.
Or do you want to start out with not doing it in an open forum and just call him up and just say,
you know.
If you think it's best, I mean, I don't have a problem calling and say, dude, you owe us some stuff, you know, it's like.
Well, you can put it on the agenda and just say response time, or you want to put like.
I can tell you, knowing Leanne, talking to him for 10 years, mm-hmm. his feelings will be hurt.
I understand, but like, you know.
But no, he needs to respond.
Yeah, he needs to respond. Right.
My feelings were hurt when he muscled the board into agreeing to a 3% raise every year. I mean, you know, that really.
A different is wrong,
when is the last time that was voted?
Lisa can look it up, but it was like just before.
It's not an annual thing, is it?
Really? Oh, yeah, every year he gets a raise.
Where was I during these?
You weren't here then. I didn't have quite the same group here.
Yes, I didn't remember already.
You have no idea how.
I never saw the contract, but I remember hearing you say like,
well, I don't get a raise every year. Yeah, when I know.
Right, it's like holy cow. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
Well, I would just, you know, Lee, in the few years that I've been on the board, you know, he seems like a member of the family. And sometimes professionals will try to develop that relationship with a group because, not that they know they can get away, but the point is, you know, when you're, it's kind of like most people are not reluctant to sue doctors these days because they see them for like 15 minutes. If that long when they come through the door. But the old family doctor that was a member of the family, you know, and this is maybe where we are here. And I would, you know, if he reacts to you, I would just tell him, you know.
Would you please send me a list of all the things he's behind and I will.
Invest in Wells
Fargo
and the ordinance. I'll send you a list.
And then if it goes to a proposal.
That'll remind me to give him a buzz.
Yeah.
And I'll do it over the weekend.
And then if that doesn't do it, then obviously he can't, his feelings can't be hurt.
Right,
it's on
notice.
Then it does on the agenda.
Exactly. Before we end the meeting, since it would apply to everybody, is there any chance that we could get these updated from time to time? Like when I looked at the investment policy that you sent me?
Yes.
This one in here is 11, from 11.
Yes.
How can we do that?
I generally email them to everyone.
So this is a self-maintained.
Right on top of this technology.
Manual and it's
basically. Yes, you should have one when you come out.
I'm not going to tell them about that.
Can you possibly send what you
say? Where can I get one? I'll drive a car with
you. You need to put this.
$1,500.
And replace the one that you have in there, which should have been the one from 2011. And then if you look in the book and you got the one from 2000, obviously, you know, your book hasn't.
And then generally, if you have an investment policy or an ordinance or something, we have copies in the room at the meeting. So that I assume you take with you.
Yeah, well, and I probably got them, but didn't realize that I needed to, you know, so maybe just a little note on there that says, put this in your book. Terrific. I'll make a motion.
I was just assuming that you would. Yes.
I would make a motion that
we
adjourn if we're there.
Thank you for recommending this. Rose, thanks for coming and giving it to us.
Very much so.
Unofficial welcome on board. Alicia.
Informative
adjourn. Meeting is adjourned.
And maybe this defensive.